From Redeemer Broadcasting, this is Holding All Things Together for this third weekend in February. I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter. What are some of the problems with welfare, and in particular, welfare over the past 20 years? Today we talk with Robert Rector, a leading authority on poverty, welfare programs, and immigration in America.
There's a very, very strong incentive not to be married. We're very fortunate that we have any low-income married couples because they all face penalties for being married. It's an insane system. Why would you do that? Well, you do that because for Republicans, it's marginally cheaper in the short term to basically only subsidize single parents. But in the long term, it's a disaster for everyone.
Also ahead, the Reverend Bill Shisco continues to deal with cultural change and how unsettling it can be. This week, he takes a look at the Christian Sabbath as God's sweet gift to mankind, as we take a weekly break and get our spiritual batteries recharged, as it were. Later in the program, writer Jerry Wiss brings us a book review of Evolution of the West, How Christianity Has Shaped Our Values, by Nick Spencer. Finally, we'll take another look at This Week in History. All this and more on Holding All Things Together.
Are you not feeling too well physically? Perhaps you're not getting enough sleep. Today, John Stone Street joins us to explain.
Get some sleep. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. Recently, I shared advice about walking during the lunch hour. Feel better? Well, good. So here's another good word for both your physical and spiritual health. Get some sleep. Writing at Christianity Today, Keith Shelnut points out that a lack of sleep can increase stress, anxiety, depression, diabetes, and heart disease. But sufficient sleep keeps us healthy and makes us more efficient leaders, increasing our productivity. Shelnut's article also cites Christian writers like Karen Swallow Pryor and Charles Spurgeon, who explain how sleep reminds us we're creatures, not the Creator, who neither slumbers nor sleeps. Rested believers are better able to serve their neighbor and less likely to bite someone's head off. Should Christians seek a theology of sleep in scripture and tradition, Shelnut writes, they'd find more evidence than I can summarize in a single article, or that I can discuss in a single commentary. So take a walk through the scriptures, begin at the creation story, and what you'll find is God has plenty to say about rest. With today's point, I'm John Stone Street.
Once again, we're blessed to be joined by Pastor Bill Shisco. Today, he talks about the Christian Sabbath.
In considering this topic of holding to the changeless in a rapidly changing world, I want you to think of the fact that this is a tremendous opportunity for the church. It's almost as if God looked ahead and saw this rapidly changing world we would be in and said, I'm going to make provision for a way to set up a counterculture in that culture. And that comes by way of honoring the Lord's Day, the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, I want to hasten to mention here, we're not talking about the Old Testament Sabbath. There is a difference in the way the New Covenant Sabbath that we call the Lord's Day is observed, but it is still one day in seven that is set apart for rest and for worship, for works of necessity and works of mercy. We don't want to take that out of the moral law of God. In so doing, we harm ourselves. How does weekly honoring of the Lord's Day help us hold fast to the changeless in a rapidly changing society? Well, the one is the most obvious. We rest. We say, I want to stop the world and get off. This is an opportunity to stop what we're doing with our regular work, with the electronic devices, and with proper preparation, even the things we do in the home. But the Lord's Day is a time that we just stop. We're not made to be 24/7 creatures. Then second, this is the time for your confrontation with the unchanging God as you gather to worship. You see this in Psalm 73 in an interesting way. The psalmist is gripped with the evil of the culture that he's in, even as we are gripped with the things coming in our rapidly changing society. And then he says, "Then I went into the house or the temple of God, then I understood their end." That's what happens when we come to the church. It's a reality check, the importance of corporate worship on the Lord's Day. And the other reason for this corporate gathering is you know that you are not alone. And for those who say, well, then I can simply do these things by going onto a computer program or by watching a video or a sermon, I want to challenge you to realize this is like trying to solve the problem of poison by eating poison. Take a break from technology, be with God's people, and honor the Lord's Day as His sacred day of rest.
I set out on a narrow way many years ago, hoping I would find true love along the broken road. But I got lost a time or two. I wiped my brow, kept pushing through. I couldn't see how every sign pointed straight to you.
On the phone line with us today is Robert Rector. He is a leading authority on poverty, welfare programs, and immigration in America for some 30 years now. He is the Heritage Foundation's Senior Research Fellow in Domestic Policy. Robert, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you.
You know, you've written a number of articles about welfare, and that's what we want to talk about today and ask you about. Seems like there's a lot of problems that are brewed with welfare, that are a result of welfare. Can you describe what some of the problems are?
Well, the major problem of the welfare state, really going back 50 years, but particularly over the last 20 years, is that all the welfare programs actually penalize low-income parents if they get married. And then the welfare bureaucracy is actively hostile to marriage. As a result of this, when the Lyndon Johnson started the war on poverty in the mid-1960s, about 7% of American children were born outside of marriage. Today, that number is 42%, and in black communities, it's over 70%. Almost the overwhelming majority of the child poverty that you hear about in the press today exists because of single parenthood, because we've pushed the fathers out of the home. But that's the good part of it. The worst part of it is that these children raised without a father in the home are overwhelmingly more likely to fail in life. Having married parents in the home is the number one factor in upward social mobility of children, black, white, and Hispanic. But even more than that, it kind of has a spillover effect. When you have neighborhoods and communities with large amounts of intact marriages, the upward mobility of everyone in those communities, all the children, goes up. This is the major problem of the welfare state. It has been for a half a century. It's a giant dead elephant in the middle of the room whenever you're talking about inner city poverty, for example, or poverty in white rural communities. But both parties are afraid to talk about this. The Democrats are really politically correct and wish to put marriage into the dustbin of history. Republicans are simply terrified and don't want to speak about this because someone will call them a name. And hopefully President Trump can break through this.
Yeah, indeed. What about the person sitting out there saying, well, I don't see the direct relationship. Maybe they've kind of missed it. You know, just honestly saying, I don't see the direct relationship between having a huge welfare state and marriages and or lack of marriages.
Well, we spent over $1 trillion last year providing cash, food, housing, and medical care for poor and low-income people. That doesn't include Social Security and Medicare. Now, about half of that goes to families with children, and most of that goes to single-parent families. So if you were to divide the welfare state into one half of it goes to disabled people and to elderly people in nursing homes, the rest of it, close to $500 billion a year, goes to families with children. All of those benefits are essentially flowing to single-parent families. If, for example, if you go into the HUD housing programs, if you look at families with children who get housing subsidies, 9 out of 10 of them are single-parent families. In every single program, it's like that. And as I said, it's even worse because what happens is that if the mother were to get married, the welfare state penalizes the couple by taking substantial amounts of money away. For example, if a woman that makes $20,000 a year marries the father of her child who also makes $20,000 a year, in one program alone, the earned income tax credit, we immediately take $4,000 worth of benefits away from that couple. They experience a 10% loss of income. Now, Republicans are just silly about this because they'll go on and on about how a welfare penalizes work, which it really doesn't do that much anymore, but they will completely ignore the fact that it has these devastating, aggressive penalties against marriage. And those penalties against marriage have been sort of like setting off an atomic bomb in the inner city. We have destroyed families there, and the crime and all the welfare dependence, everything that we see there is a direct outgrowth of the fact that we wiped out the primary anti-poverty institution in among mankind, which is the family.
Okay, that really clarifies. So if this couple is inclined to get married, actually their benefits will go down. And so there's no incentive to getting married.
There's a very, very strong incentive not to be married.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate that we have any low-income married couples because they all face penalties for being married. It's an insane system.
Oh, yeah.
Why would you do that? Well, you do that because for Republicans, it's marginally cheaper in the short term to basically only subsidize single parents. But in the long term, it's a disaster for everyone. We also do it because for the left, marriage is this medieval institution, and we just need to move beyond it to new things, basically where mothers end up being married to the welfare state instead of the fathers of their children. And everybody suffers from that, the children, the mothers, and the fathers, too, who are deprived of a meaningful role in life and left with a fairly empty existence.
Yeah. Well, hopefully for the listeners here, on this station, being a Christian station, they can really relate to and understand the need for biblical marriage. And not only is it good for society, it's a law of God, but it's also kind of a picture between Christ and his church that he chose to use.
And it's also just secular, very good public policy. Boys that are raised without dads in the home are 3 or 4 times more likely to become involved in criminal activity.
Yeah.
Girls that are raised that way are more likely themselves to end up as single mothers and end up on welfare. The kids do less well in school, and on and on. If anyone were to sit down and say, if we really wanted to guarantee that the bottom half of our society doesn't succeed, what would be the first thing we would do? And I would say the first thing would probably be to make sure that you destroy the families in low-income communities. Then I'd make sure that the schools don't work.
Yeah.
And then you could just sit down and rest, because you've probably done a pretty good job there. And that's really what we've done. And then in addition, you could make sure that there's very high levels of crime in low-income communities, making life there almost unlivable.
So true.
And wrap it up. That has been our social policy. Unfortunately, I think Republicans have been cowardly about addressing these issues, and in particular, they just faint with political correctness when the issue of promoting marriage comes up. 20 years ago, when we We did welfare reform. There was an aggressive push by very strong conservatives in the House and Senate to make sure that strengthening marriage was at the center of that reform. It wasn't successful. And since that time, Republicans have spent two decades running away from the issue. Paul Ryan, for example, who's supposed to be a leader on welfare reform, will never even mention the word marriage.
Yes.
Even though it's obvious that this is the big thing. It's not the dead elephant in the room. It's an entire herd of dead elephants. Mm-hmm. But we won't even talk about it.
Yeah.
And you clearly aren't going to solve anything by just avoiding the main issue.
Yeah, so true. In the last minute remaining, given where we are, which is an absolute mess, particularly the inner cities, some simple incremental suggestions going forward.
Well, first of all, we have to be honest about the size of the welfare state. We're spending at least three times as much as needed to wipe poverty out. We have to stop penalizing marriage, and then we ought to put work requirements on all able-bodied people who are getting this assistance to nudge them back into the labor market. For those that really are very disadvantaged workers, we have a lot of surplus money here. We can subsidize jobs for, say, ex-felons coming out of jail. People are going to have a hard time getting a job. Let's give them a hand. But what we're doing now of penalizing marriage and giving out a lot of cash without any requirements that people help themselves when they're receiving that aid is actually hurting people, not helping them.
Well, that makes abundant sense. And what about require these recipients to work or get job training in exchange for these benefits?
That would be wise, but I would again emphasize that's really actually pretty small potatoes compared to the fact that when the war on poverty started, 1 in 10 children was raised by a single parent.
Mm.
Now it's 1 in 3, and that is the big thing that has happened.
Mm.
And we basically have a taboo even about talking about it.
Yes. Well, today I've been talking with Robert Rector. He's a senior research fellow in domestic policy at the Heritage Foundation. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Are the effects of the outworkings of the gospel of Christ comprehensive in this world of ours? What were the ramifications of Christ's statement in Matthew 28 when he said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me"? This week, Jerry Wyss reviews a book by Nick Spencer. We're reminded that many of the good things in culture that are often taken for granted actually flow from the triune God graciously working his will in people's lives and blessing many others. Jerry is a frequent contributor to Holding All Things Together and is a writer for Christian Renewal magazine.
Christianity, no matter how much kicking it gets, somehow just keeps on ticking. Ever wonder why? The answer is in the Gospels. The Lord said he would never leave us or forsake us as we do the work of the gospel, both inside and outside. All power in heaven and on earth has been given to him. So his never leaving or forsaking us is, yes, a big deal. Christianity has many enemies today. The science-only crowd, the hyper-rationalist school, the revisionist historians. Actually, these are not separate enemies as such. They're all from the same source of unbelief, but use different tools. Tools, ironically enough, developed because of Christianity. To try to chip away at the stone the builders had rejected, but that nonetheless remains the chief cornerstone, Christ and his church. But what difference has Christianity really made? What has been its contribution? A slim but penetrating volume by Nick Spencer, the director of London-based think tank Theos, attempts an answer, one that should give any rationalist, revisionist, or science-only skeptic reason for pause. It's called The Evolution of the West, How Christianity Has Shaped Our Values. In it, Spencer writes that many critics of Christianity, or those indifferent to it, take for granted the West's voluntary basis for human association, where people joined together out of their own will or love to get things done. Secularists would like to think this has always been around. or that we evolved into this enlightened state. But that's not true, and Spencer, an excellent historian, shows this. Before Christianity, what brought people together were blood, that is race or identification with a tribe, and material objectives. Under these kinds of identity unifiers, rape, murder, and pillage can be justified for the sake of the group and its survival. Christianity provided people with the deepest reality as individuals rather than merely as members of a group. As though human identity is entirely derived from being a single swimmer whose entire reason for being is tied to the school of fish in which he's moving. This individuation, this self-consciousness, is where our origin of the modern world is. A regard for equality as all made in God's image despite social or economic status that thus leads to an operational legal system, the recognition of natural rights which eventually led to the development of individual liberty, and the notion of a representative government which could only arise out of common moral assumptions of equality. All this has its origins in Christianity. Spencer doesn't consider the church flawless, but he says that its flaws too often cause people to disregard Christianity and so miss the faith's communal, psychological, educational, and creative benefits. People want human dignity, political freedom, and equality under the law, but they don't want the fount from which these values spring, and which continues to supply nourishment to these values. This contradiction is as stark as it is painful in the lives of many. Quoting William Wilberforce, Spencer reminds us that we can't have Christian values without Christianity itself. Theologian J. Mark Beach has shown how it's impossible to hold to a naturalistic worldview and at once really believe in the dignity of others, in freedom or equality. Under naturalism, these are mere inventions, concoctions that can be easily dismissed. The fact that opponents to Christianity can so vociferously voice their opposition to it and get paid for doing so is itself a result of Christianity. Is there any hope for Christianity in the West, or is it on a trajectory toward extinction? Spencer is optimistic. For a long time, there has been a disenchantment with the faith in the West, but now there's disenchantment with disenchantment. In the end, all people want something more than dignity, freedom, and equality. They want something shared that's bigger than themselves, that goes beyond blood, the tribe, or material objectives. False premises have encouraged a nibbling away at tradition. That is Christianity and the blossoming garden it has produced, in an effort to get at the raw core, the mere human, as the secular self. But having arrived at this secular self, Spencer writes, we nonetheless keep on searching, not having reached the core after all, even while causing considerable damage with our nibbling attempts to do so. The book is Evolution of the West, How Christianity Has Shaped Our Values, by Nick Spencer.
Time once again for This Week in History. February 12, 1912. Sun Tsung, the last emperor of China, abdicates in the face of Sun Yat-sen's Republican Revolution. The new government ends 267 years of Manchu rule in China, and over 2,000 years of imperial rule. The 6-year-old former emperor is allowed to live in Beijing's Forbidden City, taking the name Henry Puyi. February 13, 1945. Neither an industrial hub nor a military complex, nonetheless, Dresden, Germany is the target of a massive Allied air raid beginning on this day. The city is leveled by 2,600 tons of high-explosive bombs and 1,400 tons of incendiary bombs. Estimates of the civilian death toll for 3 days of carpet bombing range from 35 to 135,000. The remains of the city will absorb another 2,800 tons of bombs before the war's end. February 14, 278 AD. A priest in Rome is executed by the decree of Emperor Claudius II. The emperor banned weddings in the belief that marriage made his soldiers weak. When he learns that a priest named Valentine is secretly performing them, he condemns Valentine to be beaten with clubs and then beheaded. Also February 14th, 1884. Tragedy hits the family of future Rough Rider and President Theodore Roosevelt, as both his beloved wife and his mother die in the same house within hours of each other. So grief-stricken is Teddy that he abandons his political career to run a ranch in the Badlands of the Dakotas. And February 16, 1804. Stephen Decatur and his men, disguised as Maltese sailors, enters Tripoli Harbor and sets fire to the USS Philadelphia, which had ran aground there the previous year. To prevent the Barbary pirates from using the vessel, Decatur has been ordered to destroy the ship on the shores of Tripoli. That was This Week in History. Events as man recorded them, as God ordained them.
That's our program for this week. Thanks for joining us. Holding All Things Together is a production of Redeemer Broadcasting, and the views expressed are those of the participants. If you'd like to help us continue to produce this program and distribute it to others, please consider supporting us. Our mailing address for your tax-deductible gift is Redeemer Broadcasting, P.O. Box 1520, Olive Bridge, New York, 12461. For Holding All Things Together, I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Cal Carter.
God willing, see you next week.